Okay, so we were talking about, so in terms of the cosmology, the Vajrayana added, in the Mahayana there were already Buddha fields and pure lands, but the Vajrayana added the Dakinis pure lands, so that was kind of an extra added one. And then also this pure land was populated, well, all the Buddha fields in the highest class Tantra were populated by peaceful and wrathful deities. So that was a change from the general Mahayana, because there everybody, it's all these bodhisattvas and their peaceful aspect. And then there was the thing that I talked about before, about this whole thing of analogies, or analogs, and the things in rituals, that there was this thought that by manipulating the substances in the rituals, which were analogous to other things, that then you could control those other things. So that was, something new that was added on, but that was kind of a new way of looking at things, that because things were empty, you could have this thing made of strings and catch somebody in it, these kinds of things, this way of changing or transforming external things and affecting external living beings. Okay? So that was something that was new. And then the whole thing about, the use of the passions and, whether they're to be used and transformed or whether they're to be subdued. And so, it was something new to think about. Although, they do say that in the Mahayana that a great bodhisattva might, be the parent of a child if that was something you desire in that way, to give birth to a child that would be a benefit in the world. But this other thing of transforming desire and anger, like you have emphasized in the highest class of Tantra, that was, kind of something that wasn't found in the general Mahayana or the Shravakayana. So it seems like they had to bring these new ideas. This is from the view of these scholars. To bring these new ideas in line with traditional Buddhist doctrine. Okay, because, superficially it does look like a change in doctrine, so they had to have some way to account for it. So they brought in emptiness, and so, that even because things are empty, then you can transform these substances and use these substances to affect people even at a great length. So that might seem like somehow like interfering with karma in some way or going beyond karma. Yeah, that somehow somebody separate could interfere or could, you could make somebody be born in a pure land, for example. Something like that, you could cause that to happen from a distance. And so the reasoning of emptiness was brought in to be able to explain that. I'm not totally clear how that was brought in and how it explains it, but somehow. And then similarly, the whole thing that seed syllables could be changed into deities and all these things like changed into different things. This is all done as a visualization practice. I'm not certain that they're trying to make this happen on the outside. But I don't know, because I haven't studied so much all these four actions, like the fierce actions and how they do those pujas and things like that. I haven't studied that. And they say that you really need to have quite secure bodhicitta in order to do them, so I don't know. The thing of breaking conventional taboos and using subjugation of other living beings in these fierce actions, that was brought in, that was explained as being skillful means. So the whole idea of skillful means became quite prominent in Mahayana, and so it was used in this case that, you know, subjugating other living beings was something skillful for them, and, you know, the unconventional behavior was something skillful, you know, for the practitioner. And then when moral precepts were being kind of gone beyond, and it looks like they're being transgressed, then explaining that as a way of helping people to go beyond fixed conceptions. Okay. So in the Bodhisattva vows, you know, you have part of your Bodhisattva vows saying that it's okay to not keep one of your pratimoksha vows if it's for the benefit of sentient beings. So, and this is often used as a rationalization. Oh yeah, it's going to benefit sentient beings for me to do this and that. Well, is it really? But it's often used as a rationalization, or at least my mind tries to use it that way. I shouldn't speak for other people. But you do have that in the Bodhisattva vows. So, for example, one of the examples that is given is, you know, because in our Pratimoksha vows we have this whole ceremony of blessing the robes, which is basically just declaring that a robe is your robe. So if there's the choice between doing that and doing something that is going to really benefit other sentient beings in a big way, then your Bodhisattva vow says it's okay not to do that small action according to Pratimoksha in order to do a bigger action that's beneficial for more living beings. So then that thought that was in general Mahayana was carried a step further into Vajrayana, saying that this unconventional behavior was again skillful means, and it was designed to help people break concepts. But you know, when I thought about it some more, I thought, well, what is it that really breaks our fixed concepts? You know, is it really seeing people do unconventional things that break our fixed concepts? I mean, it certainly makes us question things. Or even like you were saying the other day, nowadays, you know, the unconventional thing is to be celibate and not drink, you know, and to be a monastic. That's really unconventional and far out, you know, and that really breaks people's concepts. Yeah. But when I thought about what is it that really breaks our wrong concepts, it's not external behavior by and large. It is generating the wisdom realizing emptiness. Yeah, and so always coming back to that's the real purpose of all of this. You know, because unconventional behavior, to somebody else's eyes, it may or may not break their fixed concepts. It may cause more wrong concepts. You know, you don't know. So, you know, the real thing that overcomes conceptions is wisdom. Okay, these ways of explaining, you know, some of the new ways of doing things in Vajrayana were mostly drawn from the Mahayana, and that's why the mainstream that became the Theravada, they had a really hard time reconciling with the Vajrayana practice. What this book said that was really interesting, and I want to follow it up, it said that there were Theravada tantras, but none of them included transgressive elements, and by Vajrayana standards, they're tame. And instead of advocating taking on the identity of the deity, they teach the ritual action of taking on the power of jhana or nirvana. So I don't know how these texts got called Theravada tantras. I've never heard of that before. But it sounds like it's, you know, you're taking on, it sounds like very much within the Theravada system, because you're taking on the power of the, you know, the jhanas or of nirvana. But they didn't say any more than that, and I'm curious about this. Yeah?
Could you talk a little bit about the official a version of where the like the tantras come from and so forth, like the source of the tantras.
Okay. Should the official version? Yeah, I should include that, shouldn't I? Huh? Thank you. Is that during the Buddha's lifetime and also after Shakyamuni Buddha's lifetime, he appeared in the form of Vajrayana, the form of Vajradhara, and to very select disciples who were fully qualified, then he displayed the mandala and taught these various tantric practices. But they were taught very secretly, very discreetly, to only, highly qualified disciples who were mostly high bodhisattvas. Okay? So they say that, some of those could have been taught during the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, but then also afterwards that the Buddha would appear in different places and to those disciples and do that.
Some of them come from other Buddhas as well, right? Like Vajrasattva. Like, I think some of the, like, the Dzogchen Tantras came from Vajrasattva.
The Dzogchen may have, the Nyingma Tantras may have a slightly different thing, because like I know Namkhai Norbu, he actually says that this, well, he says Dzogchen isn't even a Buddhist practice, that it's kind of Bon and Buddhist together, and I think they trace it back. Is it Garb Dorje that's the center?
Yeah.
Who was like a previous Buddha or something, like before Shakyamuni Buddha. So that's more of a Nyingma take on the whole thing. Because the Nyingma transmission came in to Tibet very early on, and then what developed into Sakya Kagyu and Gelu came in much later. So the Nyingma was much, much more in direct contact with the Bumpos.
I think that kind of was kind of a Bumpo, though.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but yeah, like Vajradhara, the cosmic Vajradhara is like Kunda Tsongpo. I thought that the Tantras were like from Vajradhara and Vajrasattva, different Buddhas, but from Shakyamuni too.
Well, Shakyamuni appeared in the form of Vajradhara.
Okay.
Yeah. So Shakyamuni didn't teach the Vajrayana in the form of a monk. That wouldn't have been appropriate. So he appeared in the form of Vajradhara and gave the tantric teachings. Yeah. But the old translation and new translation, there is I was reading about this, there's some difference even in the canon, because some of the tantras that came into Tibet early on that are practiced by the Nyingmas were not included in the canon that was put together like in the 14th or 15th century. So there might be some difference in the canons there as well. Yeah. And there's like so many zillions of tantric practices. I mean, they talk about I don't know how many millions of deities. Yeah, so, yeah, millions of them. So I don't know how all that works, actually. They say there's all these different appearances of the mind of bliss and emptiness according to the disposition of sentient beings. So I guess, the omniscient minds appeared in these different forms because for some person somewhere, meditating on this particular deity would be the way to get them to enlightenment in the quickest way. Yeah. But then, having said all that, and sometimes the great masters will give these kind of collections of tantric initiations where you take 300, initiations, boom, 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 every day you take, I don't know how many. So they do have that, but then at the same time they also tell the story of how I forget who said it, but that somebody said that the Indians would take, what was it? They would take one initiation and actualize it and thereby gain the understanding of many deities, and the Tibetans take many initiations but actualize none of them. So they say this is a way of, you know, kind of getting you to, you know, focus a little bit and not just go around and collect initiations like you collect postage stamps. So they say this, and then the next newsletter comes out where there's this initiation and that one and that one. And so, I don't know.
I have read that some of the Hindu tantras, like there are some Hindu tantras that are actually, you know, incredibly similar, are actually shared amongst the traditions, like both Buddhists and, like in certain regions, historically. Like
well, there, you know, one of the talks is that people saying that what the Buddhists did is take some Hindu tantras and just change a few little details. That Pelden Lamo is really, was it Durga? I forget. Vajrayogini is Durga. And, you know, kind of saying that... What? Yeah, Kali. Yeah, maybe Pelden Lamo was Kali. And, you know, saying that they were actual Hindu practices. And so that's why some people say that the tantras corrupt, because they were Hindu practices and they just changed a few things and then called them Buddhist practices. But if you, in the Hindu practices, there are, between Hindu tantra and Buddhist tantra, there are some similarities. You know, the Hindu tantra does the whole thing with visualizations. They also do the whole thing with meditating on the channels, winds, and drops. Okay? So they have all of that too. And what they emphasize in, you know, to make sure that your practice is a Buddhist practice is you have to have refuge. Yeah? And so that's why it's so important. So it's not just verbal refuge, yes, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but I'm going to do this in true practice. But, you know, if you really have refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, then your whole perspective is a perspective of the Four Noble Truths. And so your aim is enlightenment. It's not just worldly powers. Yeah. So that's a big difference between... I've noticed that some of the descriptions of the chakra system is different between the Hindu and the Buddhist tantras. But even with in the Buddhist tantras, depending upon the practice, there's different descriptions of the chakras and things like that. His Holiness commented to me, you know, because I guess he had just had a dialogue with some of the Hindu scholars, or, you know, practitioners who were talking about Hindu tantra. And he was kind of chuckling about, oh, all these lamas will be very surprised to see that the Hindus do some of the same practices we do and that our practices aren't, you know, unique to Buddhism. You know, like meditating on the channels, winds, and drops. You know, kind of like saying, you know, we shouldn't get too arrogant about having unique practices because they're... You know, and you see it anyway, because other religious traditions have practices for gaining the jhanas also. You know, so that's why they say that samadhi isn't a unique Buddhist practice, and manipulating channels, winds, and drops is not a unique Buddhist practice. Saying mantras is not a unique Buddhist practice. You know, what's really unique is refuge and bodhicitta and emptiness. And the level of renunciation, because most other religions, well, ordinary beings, of the three kinds of suffering, ordinary beings, everybody renounces the first kind of suffering, or the dukkha of pain. Everybody, you know, even the cats and the bugs and the turkeys, you know, everybody renounces that one. The second kind of dukkha, the dukkha of change, which is what we call happiness in the desire realm, you know, other religions will even renounce that. You know, if you look at some of the Catholic monks and nuns, you know, they also say, look, you know, kind of these worldly pleasures, it just doesn't cut it, and your appearance, and, you know, having a good time, that's not what life is about. So even they can give up, you know, that second kind of dukkha. But the third kind of dukkha, seeing just having the five aggregates under the control of mental afflictions and karma, seeing that as dukkha, that only Buddhists have. You know, and if you look around all the other religions, you know, who questions this thing of having a body and mind under the control of ignorance? Nobody questions it. It's just taken for a given. You have this body and mind, and, you know, I mean, in theistic religions and many other religions, you know, you don't even burn, you're not allowed to burn the body because you're going to be resurrected, so you need this body. Yeah? So, goodness, yeah. God, talk about attachment, my goodness. Yeah? So seeing that third kind of dukkha as something undesirable, that's unique to Buddhism. Okay? And bodhicitta, you know, wanting to attain enlightenment is unique to Buddhism. And the definition, an emptiness, you know, that's something that's fairly unique because, you know, a lot of people, even lower Buddhist tenet systems, may talk about emptiness, things don't exist the way they appear, and so on. But to really check out what is the negated object, or the object to be negated in the emptiness meditation, you know, how many people really have that? How many philosophical traditions really have that? It's hard to say. You know, so sometimes people will say to me, well, all these religions, you know, we're all getting to the same place. It's just, you know, we're all climbing the same mountain, so it's just different paths up that mountain. And, you know, I say in response, I have no idea. I haven't even gotten up, followed the path to the end of the path I'm practicing, let alone the practice of the paths of other religions. I have no idea if they're going the same place. And I don't feel the need to say they're going the same place in order to create a basis for harmony with people who have different ideas than I do. I think a lot of people feel more comfortable saying this because then that's a reason to be harmonious and not be critical of other people. But I don't feel like we have to agree in order to get along, you know, or in order not to be prejudiced or intolerant. Again, just some of my ideas here.